The Guardian.
Welcome back to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. This week, I meet an actor on the up and up. British character actor Johnny Harris is going to be big, so it feels like perfect timing that he stars alongside Noel Clarke in Ben Miller's comedy debut, Huge. I'll be asking Johnny about honing his stand-up skills and facing the creme de la creme of British comedy. Plus, the drama As If I'm Not There focuses on the plight of women caught in the rape camps of Bosnia. I'll be talking to debutant Irish director Juanita Wilson. And helping me to review some of this week's other releases is Guardian film critic Peter Bradshaw. Peter and I will be discussing Transformers 3, Dark of the Moon, Robert Redford's Lincoln assassination drama, The Conspirator, and Julia Roberts and Tom Hanks on a scooter in Larry Crown. Yes, it's better and cheaper than Strawberries and Cream. It's Film Weekly. From Robert De Niro in The King of Comedy to Adam Sandler in Funny People and the aforementioned Tom Hanks in Punchline, the stand-up comic has been fertile ground for filmmakers. This week sees another contribution to this cinematic subgenre. Huge is the directing debut of British comedian Ben Miller from Armstrong and Miller, and it tells the story of a comedy double act who believe they have what it takes to be stand-up legends.
Because from now on, nothing's going to be the same. Something very big is around the corner. It's going to blow British comedy apart.
Please welcome Warren and Clark!
Thank you. Who's on? Oh, it's us.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Very nice of you. My name is Clark, and this is my assistant, Warren.
Wait a minute. You got that completely back to front.
I can't help that. It's these trousers.
That's Noel Clarke as Clark and Johnny Harris as Warren in a scene from Huge. And I'm thrilled to say that I'm joined by 50% of that duo, actor Johnny Harris. Welcome to Film Weekly, Johnny.
Thanks a lot, Jason. Lovely to be here.
Really nice to see you. I saw you at the premiere of this film, Huge, at Edinburgh Film Festival last year.
That's right. Yeah.
It's taken quite a long time to come out.
Yeah.
If I can cast your mind back to making it.
Yeah.
But is it something that you remember? Because it's a different part for you. I mean, people will be familiar with you from many of the kind of works that we've seen before. But this is quite different for you, isn't it?
Yeah. He's quite an intense little guy. He's got that intensity that some of the other characters have had. But it's a different world. You're right. It's set in a comedy world, the world of stand-up comedy.
Is that a world you know?
It wasn't until this. Until we started prepping for Huge, and I came in quite early. Ben Miller approached me quite early on, so there was quite a bit of time to prepare.
Did you say when Ben Miller, who obviously we know is a very successful comedian, he came to you and said, "I want you to play a comedian," but you're like, "Well, I'm not funny."
Well, exactly that, you know. He's the director, you know, BAFTA winning comedian, and I'd heard a rumor. It's quite vague, but I think I'm right in saying that we have a mutual friend who took Ben to a fringe show, and I was in the fringe show or something. They said, "Oh, you got to see this guy," and so there was touches of the character I play in this film is Warren Duggan, and he's just desperate, you know. He's desperate to crack it. He wants to be the greatest comedian ever, you know. And I was in the Fringe Theatre at the time years ago, you know, and playing to one man and his dog, you know, and yet inside thinking I was Daniel Day-Lewis. And so there was probably a touch of the Warren Duggans there.
Yeah, so, I mean, you just transferred it from, I suppose, the intensity that you would bring to, let's say, more dramatic roles, and you brought that to the comedian, although he is intensely dramatic, as you say.
Yeah, he's so driven. I mean, I was discussing the other day that, you know, this age of, well, not this age, but, you know, very popular shows at the moment, like Britain's Got Talent, and sometimes you see people getting up and they're desperate for it, you know, they want it, and You see the look in their eyes, and you can only believe that they believe they've got it, you know. And then the notes come out, and oh my God, they can't sing, you know. And it's like this guy, he knows the world of comedy. I mean, the first scene we see him in, he you know, he's like an encyclopedia of comedy. He's got all the theory. He's just not funny.
Yeah.
And so you know, obviously that raises humour within the film, and hopefully it's a funny. You know, it's a sweet little film.
Yeah, and I mean, I've known you quite well, Johnny, and I know how not desperate you were to make it big, if you like, but that's always been something you wanted to do. As you say, you burned with
it.
Yeah,
just
to
work, really. I mean, I you know, it's funny. I sort of, I should state, you know, because I've got a lot of friends in the Fringe, you know, Fringe Theatre scene. The Union Theatre, for example, in Southwark is a place really close to my heart. I've worked behind the bar in there, the cafe at the front, that my friends are, you know, and I've done all my early plays there. And so I love the Fringe Theatre. I think it's one of the greatest mediums for what we do, for acting, yeah, for storytelling, when it's told that close to you as an audience, you know, sometimes you're sat 4 feet away from the actors. And I've seen some of the greatest work I've ever seen in those places. So, like, you know, it wasn't like I was desperate to get away from there. It's just I never really came into the one thing I can say with my hand on heart, I went to Morley College, which is an adult education centre. It's not a big drama school. It's in Lambeth by the Elephant and Castle, which is where I live and where I grew up, where I'm from. And so at the time, I couldn't afford the drama school, or that was how it was perceived to me. You know, was that I never had the money to pay that out. And I wasn't very good at applying for scholarships and stuff. You know, I was quite naive, really. I went into the Fringe Theatre because it was the only place I could get parts.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, the guys I was working with in those plays and stuff, we took it really seriously. You know,
yeah, but I mean, one should. I mean, that is where you're going to learn your craft.
And I think it's fair to say, even when I was at Morley College, and then even when I was in the Fringe Theatre, you know, there was the desperation never came from fame. You know, this is what's interesting about playing Warren Duggan.
Yeah, I mean, because that's sort of what hangs over the film, really. It's tragedy and it's brilliance at the same time.
Yeah, you know, he's I don't. You know, we wanted to be good actors, you know, we really wanted to be good actors. The people that inspired me were, you know, I mean, they were the great actors. A lot of the New York actors of the 70s, you know, the obvious ones, Pacino, De Niro, those films, Dog Day Afternoon, Taxi Driver, Raging Bull. Those were the films that I watched and wanted to be a part of.
The thing with Huge is that it is about that desire, and it sort of crushes Warren until he gets this double act going, and it sort of changes his life with Noel Clarke, which I think is a very striking pairing, the two of you.
Yeah,
and that's what I thought was quite brave of Ben, casting two people who weren't known as comedians at all to act.
Yeah.
Because you really had to act as comedian. Not that you're not naturally charming and funny,
right,
Johnny, but it's a bit of a stretch to kind of be funny. As you talk about those films that you, Robert De Niro films that you like. I mean, you think of The King of Comedy.
Yeah.
You know, what a performance that is as Rupert Pupkin. Yeah. He's not that funny, but there's that kind of ache to be famous even for 15 minutes, which is what Warren Duggan sort of has in him.
And I think the film's sort of, in a way, if anything, I mean, not to give anything too much away, but it's a lovely exploration of that and a friendship, you know, and that all right, once, you know, Simon Cowell's pressed his buzzer, or once you've finally found out that that's not what's going to happen, what are you left with? You know, and that maybe that's a good thing, that you realise that actually, you know, we've all got lots going on for us, but sometimes we lose perspective on that because we're reading OK Magazine, or we're reading, I shouldn't say, you know, I'm not picking on that magazine, it's the only one I know.
You're never going to have you
but
in
is
there,
it, no, I'm, that's,
you'll never
that's,
be on a fireplace.
The hello mention. Spread's gone, is it? Yeah. Once all that stuff's gone, what are we left with? And I think, you know, if we all keep perspective a little bit, I've had it in life, you know, where you can lose, you know, you're so focused on the goal that you lose sight of what's around you. And I think the film's about that. It's about friendship, and it just so happens to be set in the world of comedy. Could have been set anywhere, really.
There's a scene with all the great and the good of British comedy are there. I mean, there's a kind of almost, well, it's a climactic scene halfway through where everyone is there. Everyone who's a funny in this country sort of is gathered together in one bit. So you had to do this scene in front of, well, you know, some of the
everyone,
people who I really admire, you know, Eddie Izzard to
Harry Hill, Mark Lamar, Joe Brand, just everyone was there, everyone. And there's a funny story to that. I guess it's an anecdote, you know, because it's Ben Miller, you know. Ben Miller is so well respected, you know, and quite rightly, that everyone just presumes it was because of that. But it wasn't. The co-producer writer of this and the man who got it all started, who starred in the play with Ben, because this was originally a play in Edinburgh years back, and it's taken a long while for them to get it to screen, is Simon Godley. And for those who don't know, Simon Godley is he's just a real talented guy. He wrote all of the Alas, Smith and Jones, the head-to-head scripts. And, you know, he's a real smart cookie. He's also a dentist. He gave up the comedy world. I say gave up, he's still around it, you know. He's just a very funny man, and he's loved in the comedy world. But he's a dentist, and a very prominent dentist. And he is the dentist to all of those guys, Eddie Izzard, Harry Hill. So that's how they all came in, as well as loving Ben. There was also Simon's customers. And so he got the drill in their mouth and said, you're going to be in our film or you're not leaving this chair. And so you're right. There's a scene where, you know, you probably couldn't get all those guys together in one room.
Johnny, we loved you in This Is England recently as well.
Oh, thanks.
I know that Shane Meadows is making another one of those at the moment.
Yeah.
Presumably you can't be in that.
I'm friends with the guys. Yeah, I think everyone's aware of the reputation of the This Is England cast. I mean, you know, that I've heard it said many times, they're like a family and things like that. And it's true. You know, they really are a special, unique group of people. And we're all in touch. Vicky McClure stayed over last night.
I was thrilled to see her win her BAFTA.
Yeah,
her
it's one of the great moments that I was, you know.
I don't know if people watch British TV that much. This show is a film show. But I mean, I think the scenes between you and her in that film took TV acting to a place that I don't think I've ever seen it go. I'm not sure
Jason,
I even want to see it go there again.
Yeah.
It's a one-off,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, it was something special happened, I think. We went into a room, and I never really mentioned Danielle Watson either, who played Trev, who at the end of episode 3, we did a horrific scene together as well. And we filmed that first, and that raised the bar, really. She allowed me to go somewhere that I'd not gone before. And wasn't sure I'd be allowed to go. And it was only really in the careful hands of Shane Meadows I was prepared to go. You know, it was, we knew where we had to take this subject matter, and we had to treat it carefully and with a lot of care. And so Danielle really set the bar. And I thought after that, wow, we've gone somewhere with this. And then 2 days later, Vicky and I went into a room, and we pretty much came out 3 days later with that scene in the can. And it's one I'll never forget. With Shane and Vicky, and all the others as well, but with Shane and Vicky, there's two real, real strong friendships forged, and it was because of what happened in that room. Really, I saw her go to places that I've not seen other actresses go, and that's no disrespect. I've worked with some greats, some true greats, but she raised the bar.
Yeah, no, it's remarkable television that is seared on our eyeballs, I think, forever. And just before you go, I know that you're doing War Horse for Steven Spielberg. Now, talking about spreads, and now it's going to happen with Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
What's he like? He's got a beard still?
He did have a beard. Good. Yeah, he did have a beard. There's not many people who outbeard me, but Steve gave me a run for my money. He's a modern-day Picasso, isn't he? And I got to work with him.
I can't wait to see that. I'm thrilled that Huge is out now after a year waiting for it. And that people are going to see your Warren Duggan and see a different side to you. Johnny Harris, I'm thrilled that you can come on.
Thanks,
and
Jason.
Talk about that. Congratulations
really
on Huge.
It.
Congratulations, of course, on This Is England as well. Yeah. Belated to that. And good luck with War Horse.
Well, can I say very quickly as well, you were a great supporter of London to Brighton, which was my first film ever. And it was a tiny film, £60,000 budget. And we needed a lot of support to get that scene. And you were right at the forefront of that.
Well, it was an absolute pleasure as well. Another film that I still have on DVD and occasionally put in, and then my wife says, we're not watching that again.
Yeah.
It's too hard. But for that, thank you very much.
Thanks, Jason. Cheers.
And Huge is on general release here in the UK from next Friday, the 8th of July. From stand-ups to sit-downs, from comics to critics, I'm joined by Guardian film critic Peter Bradshaw.
Once again, and golden link.
Thank you very much.
Golden
indeed.
Link.
Not only that link, but nature has provided us another link. Johnny Harris was talking about the dentist, Simon Godley.
Yes.
Dentist to the comedians, who people huge. Yes. Dentist also to?
To moi, yes. Mr. Godley is, as well as being a very talented writer and comedian, he is also a very talented dentist, of course. He's a dentist to the entire chattering classes of North and West London.
Is that what, does he put that
me.
On his poster?
Yes, exactly. That's on his brass plate outside his smart West London offices.
Well, excellent. Well, I'm surprised you're not in Huge yourself.
Well, I know. I'm a little bit upset myself.
Annoyed about that. Yeah. Yes. Maybe Warhorse.
A little bit miffed. Yes, exactly.
But Peter, this week we'll be talking about Transformers, Dark of the Moon, Larry Crown and The Conspirator. So we'll kick off, if we may, with the loud of them all. In Dolby 7.1, it's Transformers 3, Dark of the Moon. Here's Rosie Huntington-Whiteley, who's famously replaced Megan Fox, introducing Sam Witwicky to her new boss, Dylan Gould, who's, I think, Mr. Tasty, isn't he? Whatever his name. Patrick Dempsey from Grey's Anatomy, anyway.
Pleasure to meet you.
Pleasure meeting you. Carly's told me a lot about you.
Well, vice versa. It's,
oh, really?
It's a beautiful building you got. It's like the Starship Enterprise in here.
Thank you very much. It leaks. Before Carly came to help run the collection, it was just a complete mess. But now the restorations are back on track. We're going to Pebble Beach this year. We're going to get a trophy for that stand right there. You know why? Because this woman right here is my secret weapon.
Mr. Gould, please, you exaggerate. All I've done is get you organized.
Oh, you have done much more than that, my Duchess.
Nicknames, that's fun.
Yeah, The Duchess.
Peter, have you ever heard that South Park sketch where the general says to Michael Bay, can you help us defeat the terrorists? He goes, yeah, I got this idea. You get this 18-wheeler, it spins out of control, and it's like, yeah. Brush! And it's helicopters, and they burst in the
I've heard of it. I haven't seen it. Yes, yes. It's a very good idea.
There's a bit of brush yes. for us here.
There is a bit. I something weird is going on with the third Transformers movie. I never thought I would live to hear it, but I think that Mr. Bay may actually have read some of his reviews and possibly dialed it down a little bit. I can't believe I'm saying it, but he seemed to have just tilted the dial a little bit.
Has he gone down to 9, do you think?
He's gone down to 9.7 or something like that. I think he really has, because there are, I mean, may I be struck down for saying it out loud, but there are bits of Transformers which aren't too bad.
They're
not too bad.
I think he actually has admitted, both him and Shia LaBeouf, have admitted that they dropped the ball during the second Transformers.
What that means in their terms, I don't know. Dropping I ball think with an enormous crash. There's quite a bit of enriched uranium inside the ball. The opening scene, the kind of counterfactual scene about what really happened with the moon landing in 1969, is rather funny.
It's good. Well,
it's sort of pinched from Watchmen a bit. But nevertheless, it's pinched from an interesting film, and it doesn't look like a sort of stupid idea.
And it posits that an alien craft has landed on the moon, and that's why.
And that's how we got these Hasbro toys living amongst us. And there are other interesting touches. There's, you know, a couple of what I would describe as high-end cameos from John Malkovich and Frances McDormand. And you know, he seems to have recruited some kind of high-credential comics like Ken Jeong and Alan Tudyk to be in the film. Not mind-blowingly good, but nevertheless acquitting themselves very well, or perfectly well. And there's this spectacular, very overlong, I mean, at least an hour overlong, but still nevertheless very spectacular and rather impressive skyscraper catastrophe style scene. My theory is that if critics were shown these clips, say 6 or 8 months ago, out of context, and told that they were by Christopher Nolan, my suspicion is that they would be treated very respectfully indeed, because they are actually very well
done. Especially the bit where the troopers swoop from the sky with their sort of wings like the monkeys out of Wizard of Oz.
Exactly, really rather good. Of course. Apart from all that, it is still rubbish, because they have these little bits, they come on, it's almost like Nigel from the Spinal Tap.
Yeah, Tufnell.
Playing, you know, Lick My Love Pump, you know, a little moment of delicacy and interest before crashing back into
metal. You mentioned that prologue, which is the 1969, the moon landing, and then you get Kennedy and Nixon, and the people walk on the moon, they discover the and it's right, and it goes into his eye, and you see this robot, and you think, oh, this is good, it goes to his mind. And then the next shot is of Rosie Huntington-Whiteley's ass.
Yes, exactly. It's as if to say, don't worry, I'm not being a smart ass. Here's the real ass. This is what we're about. Don't panic. We've got rid of Megan Fox, but don't panic. There's no great change here. I'm not changing, you know, I'm not going to change the recipe for Coca-Cola or anything.
How is Rosie Huntington-Whiteley?
Well, I mean, basically, I suppose they must have approached Pippa Middleton. She wasn't available, so we got Rosie instead. But yes, she is exactly as you would think. I mean, she's one of these brilliant people who appears in the first scene wearing glasses because she apparently had a rather classy job with the British Embassy, apparently. We see her in Barack Obama's Oval Room office with the ambassador. She calls him ambassador, the British ambassador, presumably. She has glasses, but like all people who start off films wearing glasses, she soon doesn't need them.
Let's take it down a notch or two, Peter, and we'll go to Larry Crown.
Yes.
This stars Julia Roberts and, of course, Tom Hanks together at last. Here they are claiming their smooch was out of character.
Last night was a confluence of too many things happening in too short of a time span.
Yeah.
I believe there was an inappropriate exchange between teacher and student. I was worked up and under the influence of the demon rum. Reminded me of a spotty incident I once had with the parking lot attendant, which was... At any rate, I hope the entire thing can be forgiven and forgotten. If gossip of this nature were to circulate, it would be not only embarrassing, but my status as a professor could be tarnished.
Well, I wouldn't want that.
So no bragging to your pals about almost scoring with the drunken professor.
Well, I should scurry along. hope I don't have the same conversation with Dr. Mazzatani.
Julia Roberts playing Mercedes Tano, and Tom Hanks playing Larry Crown. A very boring name for a film, Larry Crown.
A very boring name, and a boring, worse than boring film. It pains me to say that, because I think of Tom Hanks as being a nice guy. Now, that may be a kind of an illusion.
Which has been,
his acting, his absolutely adorable turns on British late night talk shows over the past sort of 2 years, where he's just inexpressibly charming. He's a very Anglophile guy. He seems to love this country.
He loves Monty Python.
He loves Monty Python, and we sort of love Tom Hanks. But this is awful. It's the lifeless, boring, creepy, infantilized, and insulting to anyone's intelligence.
Why do you think that? I mean, Julia Roberts, who's, I think, I may counter your Tom Hanks with a love for Julia Roberts, even though she hasn't been in a good film since about 2001.
She's one of these people who I think can be very good, but here she is awful in the way that only Julia Roberts can be, when she's sort of phoning it in, frankly. She has no investment in the role, and the role is terrible.
The role is bad. Because
absolutely terrible.
Is she a bad? She's a teacher, let's say.
She's a teacher. She's jaded. And it's set up from the very word go that her interest and love of life, a love of life, is obviously going to be reignited by Tom Hanks's ingenuous, wide-eyed love of life on his own account. But before we can get on with this kind of autumn years rom-com we've got set up, he's got to have an entirely diversionary, flirtatious situation with this young, hot babe. And why? Well, I suspect it's purely to reassure the audience that our leading man is still a kind of red-hot alpha male who's capable of pulling a 20-something babe.
And yet Tom Hanks has always been this sort of man-child, except in Toy Story, where he's a sort of man-toy.
Yeah,
I don't know if he's supposed to be sort of arrested in some way in this film, because he sort of bursts in with these kind of ingenuous kind of comments, like, I don't know what to do because I've gone to college and I'm sort of a grown-up.
Exactly. He is adorable. He's a kind of lizard-like creature with no genitals in some ways. He is entirely sexless. And yet you're supposed to think of him as unintimidating, but adorable and funny and cuddly and cute.
I mean, the clip we just heard of them. They have this smooch. But I mean, it's one of the worst screen kisses
I've ever seen.
It's one of the
worst. As I say, there is zero chemistry between them. I mean, there really isn't. They look like people who have met outside their trailers for the first time. Although, of course, they may very well be very good friends. In fact, they probably are. But there's nothing going on. Absolutely nothing. I don't blame Tom Hanks and Julia Roberts for being too rich to understand what it's like to be poor. I blame him as a script writer, and I certainly blame Nia Vardalos for writing such a lot of sucrose.
She of My Big Fat Greek
Wedding. Which Tom Hanks so shrewdly shepherded to success almost 10 years ago. I blame them for writing a really ropey script.
Maybe that opening montage of him picking up the rubbish is his approach to finding scripts as well. That's how he does it.
Yes,
rummaging
exactly.
In the dustbins of Hollywood. From one huge star, Tom Hanks, we move to another of a different generation, Robert Redford, stepping behind the camera now for The Conspirator. Here's James McAvoy playing Frederick Akin, listening to Robin Wright as Mary Surratt accuse him of prejudice.
My son was in Canada that day.
Can you prove that?
I received a letter on April 14th, same day as the assassination, sent from Montreal.
Where is this letter?
I don't know.
I'm done. Done defending your lies.
You're so blind with hatred, Mr. Akin, you can't even see the truth. Yes, my son hated the North, we all did. How can a Southerner feel anything but bitterness towards your side? But my son did not conspire to kill your president. He conspired to kidnap him.
Did Robin Wright conspire to murder President Lincoln? That's the nub of this.
That's the nub of it. As it were, the take-home message of it is that it was wrong, wrong, wrong for the Lincoln assassination conspirators to be submitted to a military tribunal as opposed to a court of civilian justice. And what Robert Redford is doing is drawing a parallel with Guantanamo and the military tribunals there.
It must be the reason. Otherwise, why is he going back to 1865 and doing something that I didn't really know happened in the first place?
No. There is something very, very sclerotic about this movie. It's like everybody comes on like a sort of Madame Tussauds kind of waxwork, really, with their mutton chop whiskers and their spectacles. I actually thought, a few seconds before he came on, I bet Tom Wilkinson is in it. And he was.
He
of course
be.
He was.
Yes. Do you think he owns those mutton chops and he won't give them back.
He is just, it's just him now, isn't it? I mean, there's a generation of people who think that he is American.
Yeah.
It's like Hugh Laurie. And he does a first-class job, of course.
Of shouting.
Yes, he brings the gravitas and the vulnerability and all the rest of it, and at a fraction of the fee, frankly. I don't know that, incidentally. Yeah, it's very worthy. It's very, very worthy. It has that. It's not quite as purely infuriating as Robert Redford's last film, Lions for Lambs, but it has the same thing, that idea of a need to repudiate the right, but in a very fence-sitting liberal way, as if to say, but I'm very patriotic too, you know, don't try to get me on that, but the right have gone too far.
It was interesting that that this was based on the story of Frederick Aiken, played by James McAvoy, who
yes.
also in Mutton Chops and Nice Beer,
yes.
who
yes.
has to defend, the nice man defending...
It's a typical thing. It's like, you know, if it was set in sort of South Africa, you'd have the black character and the white character. And this is, you know, the northern character and the Confederate character and indeed a Catholic character. It's balanced. It's impeccably liberal. It's a sort of thing that could be shown on a TV, on one of those TVs that are up on sort of stilts that are wheeled out in front of high school sort of classes. I can imagine that's what this movie is.
Well,
going
it says
to,
at the beginning, the isn't it? It's by movie. The American Film Company, which
yes.
is Filming History. Is
yes,
sort
Filming
of
History. It's a real kind of History Channel stuff. It should be exciting, but because you saw everything's blanded out and balanced out from the get go. There's nothing at stake, and there's nothing exciting.
Danny Houston is in this as well as the sort of prosecutor.
Yeah,
and all he does is seem to sort of shout back something that someone's just
yes.
said.
He just looks reptilian and malevolent in a way that he obviously is very good at doing. And Kevin Kline has gone into what he presumably imagines to be full Dick Cheney mode as the Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, who is a real hard ass and wants to preserve the integrity of the state at the expense of panty waist considerations like civil rights, blah, 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 blah. it should be great. I wondered if maybe Aaron Sorkin had written it. It would have been, of course, four times as long, as everybody would have had four times as much to say. But by golly, that if you wanted debate, if you wanted liberals confronting other liberals with a contest about who gets to be the most patriotic, then Aaron Sorkin could have certainly delivered, I think, a more interesting script.
Interesting, I note that that Frederick Aiken left the law after
yeah.
this. He's not giving anything away particularly. And went to work for, he was the first city editor at the
Washington Post.
Which brings us all neatly round, because, of course, yes. that's where Robert Redford worked in All the President's Men.
Yes, that's true. I'd forgotten about that. But yes, as I say, it's another interesting fact, but one which, again, makes my heart sink. It's a kind of, and everything's liberal. Do you understand? His credentials as a liberal have been unimpeachably asserted here with the fact that he worked as the city editor for the Washington Post. Again, interesting, but I mean, it's a history lesson from a slightly boring history teacher.
Bland from the Blonde there by Robert Redford. Peter, thank you very much indeed for all your reviews this week. For more of Peter's reviews, go to the best film site on the web, guardian.co.uk/film.
Thank you.
In the drama As If I'm Not There, Samira, a young schoolteacher from Sarajevo, is delighted to take up a teaching role in a rural Bosnian village. However, the thunder of civil war soon interrupts her idyll. What unfolds is a story of horrific violence as Samira, played by Natasha Petrovic, attempts to survive her enslavement. The film draws on testimonies by women made to the International Criminal Tribunal in The Hague and is a courageous feature debut by the Irish director Juanita Wilson. I spoke to Juanita Wilson on the line from her home in Dublin, and I began by asking her how she became drawn to these horrific stories.
Well, I remember at the time of the Bosnian War, when the first reports came out about the rape camps being absolutely just devastated, that none of us in Europe seemed to be able to intervene to kind of stop the horror. And I remember thinking, I mean, for a woman particularly, you know, how would you survive a nightmare like that, where you're being held basically, you know, in a women's room, not knowing every time when the door opens what's going to happen to you next? And how do you stay sane in that situation? And so years later, I came across a book by Croatian writer Slavenka Draculic, which covers really the story of a young woman who is caught up in this situation. And it's based on true testimonies from women who came out of the camps. And her book is absolutely extraordinary. It described the experience in a way that you could really relate to it and understand it. And it had kind of elements that I'd never heard before, such as fear producing a kind of a numbness or a paralysis or shutting down, rather than producing adrenaline, which is always what you assume is kind of the dramatic response to fear.
Yes, absolutely. There's a moment, isn't there, where she watches a fly, which I think is an extraordinarily dramatic moment. It reminded me of Emily Dickinson, who saw the poem where she saw a fly when she died, and she talks about the hour of lead when she died.
Yeah.
So it's amazing that you talk about numbness, because that exactly what it actually kind of summed up for me, that she'd gone numb, she just
and
watched the fly.
The idea of kind of block something out, you know, all the strategies you use, and believing that something is not happening to you, which is, you know, the state of trauma, which is how the novel and the film got its name, you know, as if you are not there, it's not happening to you. So you kind of transcend the experience almost in order to survive it.
And indeed, she has an out-of-body experience at one point, which is rather poetically done by you. I mean, you sort of mentioned it is the sort of film that invites what would I do in that situation? That's the sort of response. How would I react? And it's interesting to watch your film and kind of say, well, why don't they do this? Or how don't they do that? It's a film that invites you to get involved in some way. It's so unimaginably horrific in a way, that the situation, that you kind of think, well, it has to be made up. This can't really be happening.
Right.
But it was.
Yeah, well, it is. It's that kind of dilemma, I guess, that interests me, exploring those human dilemmas, and particularly war situations where they really test our humanity, you know, and you do ask yourself, if you were in that situation, how would you respond? Would you be the cruel guard or the kind guard? Or, you know, if you were in that situation, fortunately, I personally haven't been myself. So
your heroine, Samira, she has the choices to make, because in a way that she is the pretty one, if you like. Yeah. That's something that that kind of stands, you know, is both to her advantage and her disadvantage.
Yeah, well,
it?
I think it's interesting because you're kind of turning the whole notion of beauty on its head. You know, as women, we're always encouraged to stand out, to look attractive, to be beautiful, and that's always seen as being a great quality. But in this situation, you know, it's the most dangerous quality. So it was kind of interesting to play with that. But in the end, she kind of decides to hold on to her identity, even though she's been stripped of everything. You know, she decides that she will hold on to her identity, and that's what keeps her sane.
And is that what comes out from the end of your film? It says it's based on true stories. So I imagine it's an amalgamation of several stories. This is the sort of thing that happened. What had people that I don't know if you spoke to or that Slavenka has spoken to in writing the novel? What is it that how they got through the war? What is it that comes out intact as a survivor?
I think it varies very much from one to the other. I mean, you know, they all have so many different experiences and survive in different ways. Some people, you know, obviously try and forget to move on. Some people need some kind of, you know, to be heard in order to move on and leave the pain. Some people strive to forgive, and some people just will never actually achieve that. So I think it's a very, very personal situation. I don't think there's a generic kind of survival gene or survival experience.
Now, you shot the film in Macedonia, and it's just from the final credits. Tell me about your actress, Natasha Petrovich. I'd never seen her before. She's an extraordinary performer. She reminded me of a young Natasha Kinski, if I may say.
Natasha was a real find. I spent 9 months in total driving around the Balkans from Belgrade to Zagreb, Sarajevo, looking for somebody who was young and could play the role, who was an observer, but who was smart enough that you would believe would be able to read clues and take her chances and survive in a situation like that. So it was quite a difficult and unique combination of characters to find. And eventually, when trying to cast one of the smaller roles, literally the week before we went into official pre-production, I saw her photo and she just stood out. I think her eyes are just so haunting. Mm. So I brought her in to audition for the smaller role and then just literally threw her in the deep end. And it was amazing because within the space of like 5 scenes, you know, from the start of the film through to the end, I just saw this young, unassuming teenager grow into this woman who had been through the worst that life can throw at them. And I don't know where you get that talent from, but
But she's a student, right? She's not a professional actress.
No,
yet.
She's in drama school. She's just finished this year. At the time, she was in her second year, I think, just finished her second year. So, yeah, amazing. Absolutely amazing. I was so relieved. to find her.
Well, I think, I don't know, you know, how many people are going to see your film and see her and what's going to happen to her, but I mean, she's got a huge career ahead of her, it seemed to me.
She deserves extraordinary. It, absolutely.
And she can thank you for that, if in a way. I mean, the film is, you know, it isn't a pretty experience to watch, although the countryside is, you know, starkly beautiful in its own way. And it's a tough watch. But nevertheless, I found it absolutely compelling and gripping and extraordinary. How do you tell people that that your film, which is harsh, let's be honest, is something that they want to put themselves through? Because I found it haunting and beautifully done, and I loved your close-ups, and I found it, it worked in my brain long after I'd seen it. But how do you convince people that this is what they need to see?
Well, I guess, first of all, there's something really important for all of us, I think, to bear witness, and that's why I guess I'm drawn to strong stories and true stories, just as part of our human experience, to try and understand conflict. But for me personally, even though it's a war story, for me it's always been a story about love, you know, love of family, romantic love, love turned on its head, and obviously ultimately love of yourself and of humanity. And for me there's a very strong message of hope in the end of this film that is very, very important as well, and cliched and all though it is, that ultimately, despite everything, that love is stronger than hate.
And I think that comes through extremely strongly in your film. Juanita Wilson, thank you so much for joining us. You'll be speaking at the ICA this Friday, where your film is playing, As If I'm Not There, an extraordinary piece of work that is both beautiful and haunting. And indeed, What Will Survive of Us is Love, is what comes out of your film. So thank you so much for joining us on Film Weekly.
Thank you, my pleasure.
Thanks to Juanita Wilson, and As If I'm Not There is on release at the ICA in London from Friday the 1st of July. That's all for this week. The music we've been featuring on the show is the bombastic score to Michael Bay's Transformers 3 Dark of the Moon by composer Steve Jablonski. Listen for that. Rush! There it goes. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and Film Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.
Great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.